Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, May 2nd, 2011. We are going to start. I thought I saw Senator Higgins here. There she is. We're going to start with Senate File 878, Senator Higgins. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this your first visit to our committee?
Yes, it is.
Right.
I used to chair state and local government when it was one committee combined, so it feels like coming home.
All right.
Mr. Chair, there should be two amendments, and if you would have them passed out while I say my introductory paragraph, that would be great. And they would put them in the order I'd like to have you.
I know the Second Amendment is on its way. We have the first one here,
okay,
though, I understand.
Okay. Well, members, and then I think you have a couple of handouts in your packets, maybe? One, a reprint of an article from the Star Tribune and the other from the Baker Williams LLP. Are they in your packets? I hope.
You say they were from again, Senator?
Baker Williams, LLP. The title is Presumptive Certificate of Rehabilitation for Military Veterans. And then an article from the Star Trip. They were given to your page earlier today. So, okay, well, anyway, somebody will find them and get them handed out to you as well. Members, I received the idea of this bill, Senate File 878, from John Baker of Baker Williams, LLP, who is retired from 22 years in the Marine Corps and now is a partner in a law firm that specializes in legal work for veterans, service members, wounded warriors, and their families. He is also one of the leaders of the Military Action Group at the legislature. Senate File 878 would allow an honorable discharge from the military to serve as evidence of rehabilitation for veterans who had committed a crime before they went into service and upon return from military service, and when they are when they return from military service are denied employment or licensure based on the offense from before they went into service. This is a jobs bill. The United States Department of Labor recently reported that the unemployment rate of Iraq and Afghanistan-era veterans jumped to a record 15.2% in January. During the same time, the overall national unemployment rate declined. This is becoming a national crisis, but I think here in Minnesota we can do this one piece that will break down barriers to employment for our next greatest generation of veterans.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Wigger moves the A1 amendment.
Author's amendment.
Author's amendment. Mr. Bodern, can you just, it looks pretty simple.
Mr. Chairman, what this does is just on page 2, line 16, makes it clear that these procedures apply to both a conviction for a gross misdemeanor and a felony crime.
And, Mr. Chair, many of the offenses that we think are pretty serious crimes are gross misdemeanors rather than actual technically felonies, and so this would give them the weight that they deserve.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Senator Higgins.
We found A2 yet?
I got a copy of it.
Okay, we'll keep talking then. Mr. Chair, I have with me Ms. Tristram.
Senator Higgins, I don't know why Senator Wigger started laughing when you said you could keep talking.
Senator Wigger and I are classmates. We have been here together 15 years, and so he probably remembers when I first came to the Senate, I couldn't say a single word in committee or on the floor without my voice shaking, my hands shaking, and the papers I was trying to read from shake. And now I've just turned into somebody who can yammer on and on and on. So,
right. Thank you. I want to let the record show that we do have a quorum. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have with me today Trista Mattis Castillo. Trista is a veterans advocate and chair of the Women's Veteran Initiative Working Group. A veteran herself, and she can give you some very good information about why this bill is so important.
All right. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trista Mattis Castillo, Chair of the Women Veterans Initiative Working Group. Nice to see you again, Senator Perry, and go Army. I am here in support of this bill and can give you several examples of where this would work. I was a commander, outgoing commander of the 34th Military Police Company most recently in my 16 years on active duty. And as a commander, as recruiters would come in with new recruits and needing waivers so that they could join the service, many of those waivers were to do with perhaps someone who had admittedly smoked marijuana at some point in their youth or got a DUI or something of that nature, but were now ready to serve our country at its best and the finest. And then these folks will go off and serve and come back with their DD-214. You know, they're all grown up now with great service and a record of that service, but then they go to get a job and they can't because that record previous to military service will hold them back. An example of this would be in the area of law enforcement. As I said, I commanded the military police company. Many of those folks would like to become police officers after their service, but they're ineligible if they had that kind of a waiver. So this would give them the opportunity to show that they have indeed grown up, learned their lessons, served our country well, and would like to continue serving our country. There are literally hundreds of examples and that I could give if you'd like more, but we'll be brief. And I'm ready to answer any questions if you have them.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Mattis Castillo, can you talk about what kinds of offenses would make you not eligible for military service in the first place?
Yes. So this question comes up a lot. If you have a felony in the way of any kind of domestic assault or violence, you will not be eligible for service. There are some felonies that can get waivers. Those are typically those very low-level felonies, i.e., you caused damage to someone's personal property in the amount of $3,000. So a teenager that maybe spray-painted a car and it cost more than $3,000, that would be a felony, but we would still allow them into the military. So we look at it case by case. So if it is sexual violence or sexual predatory, they're not in the military, nor would they get a DD-214 that's as honorable if they're charged while serving or domestic assault in any way.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really glad we're adding gross misdemeanor. I'm just wondering if there's the lower levels, do those have any impact at all, misdemeanors? I mean, I just assume the rest of that stuff be wiped clean if it is a factor, and maybe it isn't, but I just want to make sure.
It is. All of those smaller things, it depends on what the job is and who the employer is. The unfortunate thing with veterans, and you can hear these stories all the time, is that they're coming back and our employers don't necessarily know what they're getting. And there's a lot of media coverage about post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'll tell you, it makes employers really worried. They don't know if someone's going to go, quote, postal or not. And we have a very small number, actually, of these veterans. And a DD-214, they're pre-screened and all of those things. So, you know, this is just a way to show that veterans, look, we're safe, we're employable, and we have some real skills. And so sometimes it totally depends on the employer and what the job is.
Senator
Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure that if we should have added misdemeanor in there, too, that we don't waste this opportunity for the veterans.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, the sentence that we amended deals with someone who commits a crime after they have gotten one of these after they've come back from service, and they've then committed another crime. And that would be a gross misdemeanor or a felony, and that would then rescind the what are we calling this thing? The presumption of rehabilitation.
Yep.
Okay. I think if we're going to take it down to just the misdemeanor level, it could be a very, very small offense that would get them in trouble again, and I'm not sure we want to go quite that far.
No, that Mr. Chair, I was actually thinking it was prior, and we were wiping it. I see what you're saying.
Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, I move the second author's amendment.
Senator Wigger moves the A2 amendment. Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, that amendment is being distributed right now, and I just got hold of a copy of it. Okay. Senator Higgins may be in a slightly better position to explain this, but this is codified in Chapter 245C, which relates to the Commissioner of Human Services.
That's right.
Senator Wigger. All right, Senator Higgins. Go
ahead. Mr. Chair, this comes from Licensing Department of Human Services. They were concerned that they would have to put a fiscal note on this if they would have to go and find out beforehand whether somebody was a veteran. They do more than 1,000 background checks a year. Well, they say a day. I'm not sure that's quite right. Well, anyway, they do a boatload of background studies. And somehow they would have to find out who was a veteran, which would be one more step. And so what this would do is say that if the veteran was disqualified but has the DD 214, all they would have to do would be to come in and show the DD 214, and the disqualification would be rescinded. So rather than trying to check it out for everybody, it would be on the veteran to follow up and say, no, I'm a veteran. I qualify for this certificate of rehabilitation, and then they would rescind it, rescind the disqualification.
Thank you. Mr. Bodern, just a question on this. If on the A2 amendment, if after page line 5 we insert section 1, will we have to change the section and the numbering through, because we would have two section 1s then? Is that how I understand that?
Mr. Chairman, there is an instruction on these amendments, and you see at the bottom to renumber the sections.
Thank you. I did.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the A2 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 878, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
Senator Wigger moves that Senate File 878 be recommended to, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd just like to offer my commendation to the author for her hard work on this, and also to note Mr. Baker would like to be here. He did the heavy lifting in getting a lot of the background support. He's also a constituent and a very proud Marine who has devoted him his career now in law to helping veterans. And it is a jobs bill.
Mm-hmm. On Senator Wigger's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator Higgins.
Let's go back to the top of our schedule here, Senate File 1101, Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I apologize for being here a little bit late. I know you had me on the agenda first. I appreciate that, and we just got a little bit tied up. I do want to present Senate File 1101. I do have a question, however. We adopted an amendment in our committee that does not seem to be reflected in the copy that is before the committee, and I just am concerned about that process. I'm not sure what that...
Do you know where that amendment went or what it addressed, Senator Hahn?
Yes, there was a change in the language on line 1.11, the word partner was changed to advocate, and then there were some a sentence added on page 1, line 24 after the period, and then on page 2, line 14 after the period that talks about staffing of the task force. And I thought that would be pertinent language to be before your committee, and I'm just not sure why it is not reflected in the copy of the bill that I picked up here on your distribution.
Was Senator Hahn, was that passed today?
No, Mr. Chairman, we passed that, not sure exactly the day, it was last week, Thursday.
So it was referred. So it wasn't signed yet. Can we get that so that we have it? Because if it's...
Okay. Senator Hahn, we'll proceed. Staff is going to go run some new copies, and then we'll have that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. I just thought that that was language, particularly the language about the staffing of the task force would be appropriate for your committee to be aware of.
Correct.
And so I checked when I came in to look at the bill that was on the distribution, and I said, well, that's not included and probably should be. But what I would like to do is just briefly mention that this is one of three bills that is proceeding through the legislature dealing with this, is my life, my choices, the general overall structure of it. This particular bill has to do with a task force that would be created. And we do have a testifier from LSS that I think could probably speak more to the committee and the origins of this idea and the purpose of it. I'd like to ask your consideration for that testimony.
Please state your name and you may proceed.
Thank you. I'm Jody Harpstead, the Chief Operating Officer at Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota.
Could you spell your last name, please?
H-A-R-P-S-T-E-A-D.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to thank several of you who have been very supportive of our services over the years. Senator Gazelka, coming from the area where our services are headquartered. And Senator Perry, I learned just before testimony today that you were tweeting a visit to one of our services recently in your area, and we appreciate both the visit and the tweet. So thank you for
thank
that.
You. Mr. Chair.
For some reason, I just don't know if I should let you. Go ahead, Senator Dibble.
I don't know what you don't tweet. That's what it
is. Please proceed.
But we appreciated that. This year at Lutheran Social Service, we are really living the adage that that necessity is the mother of invention. As we face into this difficult budget this year, it has caused us to imagine a whole new world for people with developmental disabilities in Minnesota, and it's been quite an adventure. Working with the Public Strategies Group, we've put together a design that includes many of the hopes and dreams of the advocacy community, of people with disabilities in Minnesota, their families, providers, the Department of Human Services, and others. Some of the highlights of that design include taking the very many pots of money that come into Minnesota for people with developmental disabilities, putting them together in an individual budget that a person can see, giving that person direct access to those dollars through a fiscal support entity, and allowing a person with disabilities and their trusted partner, now called their advocate, to go into the marketplace and buy the services that they need. The design also includes a dream that the system be designed in a way that maximizes independence instead of minimizing risk for people with developmental disabilities in our community, to allow them to fully participate and contribute to the community. Senator Hand's bill here today forms a task force because all of those hopes and dreams are hard to put into a single bill in a single session. And the task force would continue to meet after this legislative session to continue to work out elements of the design that we couldn't work out in this session alone. And so there are areas we've run into that require ironing out of some intricate regulation. There are areas we've discovered that bump into federal regulation. And so to continue the work after the session, and the expectation would be to bring additional legislative changes to the 2012 legislative session to continue to design this world called My Life, My Choices. Be happy to answer any questions.
We have any questions. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, your testimony indicates it's for folks with developmental disabilities, but the bill itself doesn't specify that. It just talks about disabilities.
Ms. Harpstead.
As Senator Hand said, that this bill is part of three bills that discuss all of this concept, and I think the others are clearer that we're talking about people with developmental disabilities. But you're right, it just says people with disabilities in this one.
Senator Collins.
So, Mr. Chairman, does that need to be specified then in this bill, or?
Perhaps.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Hand.
And I don't want to speak for Lutheran Social Services, but my understanding and conversations I've had throughout this process is I think that the general term is fine. I think particularly with respect to the task force, what they're looking to do is explore how we can do this differently, and it may be appropriate to have that be a little bit more broad in scope. But
actually, that's helpful. Thank you. The first bill that we have with more specific changes to the current regulation is specific to people with developmental disabilities, but this policy bill creating this ongoing task force doesn't need probably to be as precise.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Then that would raise another question in my mind, and that would be the membership of the task force as to why you would have only one individual with disabilities then.
Mm.
And you've got multiple people with representing two family members, representatives of various organizations, but why would you have only one person with a disability
mm-hmm.
as opposed to possibly, I'm not sure what the correct number might be, but people who would represent different disabilities and could offer some thoughts to the task force.
Mm-hmm. That could be helpful. Also, many of the providers and advocates and others represent people with all different kinds of disabilities that would be able to bring that perspective to the task force. But that's a good point.
And Mr. Chairman, the reason I raised the question is, if somebody has a very significant developmental disability, possibly that they're not encompassed with what your intent is, if they're just totally institutionalized. But certainly, if we're talking a range of disabilities, sight, hearing, whatever, those folks would be as capable of offering some perspective on this as any of the advocates could.
Sure.
That's true. Comment about that.
Any other questions? Senator Hand.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wiggins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question at line 2.12. Senator Hand, that's a very optimistic statement, and recommendations from the task force shall be fully implemented by July 1, 2013.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Wiegar, I think that is to coincide with the date that the task force is set to expire.
And it's been removed in the amendment.
And I believe, as just being reminded here, that expiration date
is July 1st of 2013.
Yes, I think the that particular line 2.12 is deleted as part of the amendment that we adopted in the committee last week. It's the amendment that we had starts on page 1, line 24.
Senator Hand, we have the new engrossment.
Okay.
And that is deleted, Senator.
Okay.
Wiegar. Senator Hand, I think I'm just I've been talking with staff here. I'm not sure that things are flowing here when I look at starting in line 1.19. It says, in addition, the following shall be appointed jointly by the Speaker of the House and the Senate Subcommittee on Committees of the Committee on Rules and Administration. I'm looking through that, and I know we've been speaking with staff here and Mr. Bodder, and I'm not sure if that if something doesn't seem right there. And then on line 2.2, when we're talking about ex officio members, are they voting or not members? I don't know, Mr. Bonner, and I know we've been looking at this, and I'm just wondering maybe what your thoughts are on some of the verbiage here.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that's one of the reasons why we're in this committee is to evaluate the structure of the task force. I think, I'm not trying to speak for the intent or the hope that Lutheran Social Services has for this, but I think the idea was that a portion of this task force would be people appointed by the governor. The other portion would be people appointed by the members of the legislature. I had assumed maybe incorrectly that serving as an ex officio member would mean a voting member unless otherwise stated. But I think certainly the pleasure of the committee would be to make adjustments that you believe to be workable here. But I think the concept is to try to have a structure that would be representative and have that the selection be distributed between the executive and the legislative branch.
Mr. Bodden.
Mr. Chairman, so just a few thoughts on the way this has been handled in other legislation on line 1.19, where the Speaker and the Senate Subcommittee on Committees would collaborate to make these appointments. I think in the past that's been found to be unworkable. It would be best to separate those appointments and task the Speaker with some of them. And I think perhaps even the Majority Leader, again, this practice varies, but for more advisory and short-term committees like this, it's often best to have the Majority Leader make the appointments because that can happen swiftly. So obviously it would be the committee's pleasure on how to separate those appointments. You could begin with the first two, the representative of a disability advocacy organization and the representative of a disability legal services advocacy organization as appointments for the Speaker, and then make the remaining three on line 1.23. I think that refers to two representatives from nonprofit organizations, and then the representative of a philanthropic organization appointed by the Majority Leader. I can brush up an oral amendment here that would take care of it. It may be a little difficult, but I can read to you the way the sentence would read once amended. And then I appreciate Senator Hand's point on the on page two. I'd like to ask to confirm that the understanding is that the ex officio members are indeed voting members. There's often confusion about that. So I can prepare the oral amendment in a minute or two here.
Well, I think, do we have any other testifiers, Senator Hand?
Mr. Chairman, no.
You know, here's what I would like to do, if it's okay with you. I'd just like to lay this on the table. And I think we have room on Wednesday. We can bring it. I would much rather have the language in written form so we make sure it makes sense. I think that's the wise move, and we can squeeze it in. And
Mr. Chairman, that's fine. I think it would be helpful to have some language in front of us. I'm happy to do an oral amendment, but I think Mr. Bonner has captured, at least from my perspective, a structure that would work, and if you think it warrants another shot, I'm happy to come back.
I would like to do that unless our legal counsel is okay with trying to move it forward. But
Mr. Chairman, another option. I'm completely comfortable with whatever method you want to pursue here. Another option would be if you want to allow me a little more time, I can get it in writing, within a few minutes here.
What do we have? We're going to lay this on the table for about 10 minutes.
Sure.
And by doing so, that will give I hear legal counsel saying he can get this done so it makes sense and we can move forward on it. So we'll lay Senate file 1101 on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's call up Senator Lilly here, Senate file 904. Welcome, Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 904 is a bill dealing with depository collateralization, which is not something we generally talk about every day, but we'll learn a little bit about it as we're talking here. State law requires that all government entities to designate one or more financial institutions as a depository for its public funds. As protection for the public funds, financial institutions selected must collateralize these public funds at the rate of 110%, meaning 10% more than the actual funds, which offers more protection to those who are placing the funds, the public. Collateral can be in the form of deposit insurance, corporate surety bonds, or pledged collateral. State law defines the types of securities that a financial institution may pledge as collateral for those public deposits. It was recently discovered by the Department of Management and Budget that the law regarding using FDIC insurance as part of the collateralization requirement for the state deposit was not as clear as a similar law for local government deposits. MMB has requested this bill that we have in front of us to clarify that FDIC insurance can be used as part of the financial institution's collateralization requirements. The bill does not change that 10% increase in the or the 110% of the deposits. I just wanted to clarify that also. And I'm joined by two folks here, Joe Howell from MMB and Tess Rice from the Minnesota Bankers Association, and they will talk to the bill also.
We'll let ladies go first. Is that what we can do? Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tess Rice, General Counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We support this bill because we think it makes sense to consider FDIC insurance when collateralizing state funds, and we think it makes sense for public deposits to all be treated the same. So this would change it to be the same as counties and cities and school districts' funds.
Any questions? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm then that the same FDIC limits apply as far as insurance protection.
Ms. Wright.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Yes, it's $250,000 for most deposits, and then there's an unlimited right now, a temporary unlimited guarantee for non-interest-bearing accounts.
State your name.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Joe Howe. I'm Director of Operations, Treasury Operations at MMB. And basically, as Senator Lilly already addressed, MMB fully supports this bill. So I'm just here if there's any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
I'd like to move Senate File 904 to be moved, passed onto the floor.
Senator Lilly moves that Senate File 904 be recommended to pass. Any further questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lilly. Senator Lilly, while you're there, let's just go right on to Senate File 1159.
So we do want to continue?
Yes.
Just a second. I'm waiting for others to join us. Okay. All right. Well, I'll go ahead and start.
I do have your A4 amendment up here, Senator Lilly, if you want to move that.
I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Senator Lilly moves the A4 amendment. I'll be passing it out.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, perhaps explain a little more about the actual bill.
Sure.
And then come back to the A4. Would that be acceptable? Or do we need to?
I would much rather move on the A4 amendment if you could focus on that first.
Okay. So the A4 amendment is regarding an investment of $600,000 in software that schedules the hearing judges for the workers' comp programs.
I see that. I think everyone has the A4 amendment pretty straightforward here.
And again, Mr. Chair, we will spend a fair amount of time setting the stage for this amendment and the rest of the bill that's in front of us.
Any questions on the A4 amendment, author's amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Now on Senate File 1159 as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. So this statute is basically a work with the Workers' Comp Advisory Council, which was set up a number of years ago as a relationship underneath the purview of the Department of Labor and Industry and under Commissioner Ken Peterson, who's here with me at the table. And this council includes folks from labor, from industry, and four legislators. Myself and Senator Kielash are the senators on it, and Kiefer and Mahoney are the representatives that serve on the council. And also on the relation on the council is the Office of Administrative Hearing, and Chief Judge Raymond Krause is here with me today also to talk about the segment that is in the amendment that we just heard. Basically what this council does is we worked together unanimously to approve by business and labor through the Workers' Comp Advisory Council this recommendation that both insurers, employers, and injured workers have all been represented. The bill addresses the timing of settlement conferences, which actually in the past have taken up to 212 days on average, and through the changes that are in this statute will be reduced to about 180 days. It also allows for flexibility in scheduling of these meetings, of these hearings, and the use of experienced and independent decision makers at the hearings. A change in the formula for calculating medical fees and drugs used to treat a workers' comp injury. And the bill also makes some technical changes incorporating existing workers' comp changes, law changes, since it has been enacted in 1998. And if I could ask, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Bodern talk about the issues that are directly in front of this committee, could we please address that?
Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, a fair amount of this bill is actually within the jurisdiction of the committee. When you look at the first few sections that are all coded in Chapter 14 of the statutes, they relate to the organization of the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is under the jurisdiction of this committee. So that's sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you get into some of the changes that are being made in the workers' comp proceeding statutes. I think that takes care of it. I just want to confirm by looking all the way through. There is also on page 10, there's the appropriation made in section 21, the appropriation made to the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is another item under the jurisdiction of this committee.
All right, thank you. Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to now ask Commissioner Peterson to talk about the actual statute that's in front of us.
Commissioner, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. As Senator Lilly just pointed out, the tradition has been and the law has been that before the legislature take up workers' comp bills, that it first goes through the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. And that's been in existence, I believe, since 1993 or 94, sometime in that area. And that was the idea behind it is to have a group of representing both labor and management, as well as the legislature, to thoroughly vet, to discuss the issues, to make sure that there's a unanimity between both sides of the workers' compensation agreement, and that so the legislature does not have put up with the various contentious. Potentially contentious items that are, by their nature, part of workers' compensation. So, this bill, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council met, deliberated, I think, for 5 or 6 hours over three meetings, and came to these conclusions and present this bill. The chief part of the bill is to streamline work at both the department, but most of the bill relates to work at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and just allows the chief judge, Judge Krause, just gives him leeway to move ahead on to make the system go faster. The chief problem with the workers' compensation system has been just the delay in disputes. Those of you who talk to constituents, I'm sure that's one of the leading complaints you hear, that just takes too long to get complaints done. So this bill would speed up complaints, helping both management and labor, insurers and healthcare institutions, and various parts of the workers' compensation system, just help get decisions done quicker. It also, as Senator Lilly pointed out, it has an appropriation that would come out of the workers' compensation special fund for $600,000 to pay for a case management system that would also have the effect of speeding cases or would help the Office of Administrative Hearings speed up their cases. The $600,000 there would not be an increase in the assessment. The Workers' Compensation Division and the Workers' Compensation Section of the Office of Administrative Hearings is paid for out of an assessment on workers' compensation insurance. There would not be an increase in the assessment to pay for this. But in terms of specifics, I'm certainly open to answer any specifics you have on any of the issues before you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson, if it doesn't increase the rates, is it because there's enough in there to provide for it?
Commissioner Peterson.
Senator, yes.
Okay.
Senator Lilly, I've got a couple of questions. Here is the I know there was some discussion early on in session, I think, that we had, and there was some talk about compensation judges. And maybe you can help me. There are how many judges and how many – I mean, what makes a compensation judge? I mean, is that the only thing the judge works on, or – I know we had some discussions early on about that.
Mr. Chair, we are joined by Chief Judge Raymond Krause, and perhaps he could address that.
Okay. Judge Krause.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Raymond Krause, Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, we have two divisions, the Administrative Law Division and the Workers' Compensation Division. In the Administrative Law Division, we have 7 judges. And in the Workers' Compensation Division, we have 23 judges. The 23 Workers' Compensation judges do primarily workers' compensation. They do from time to time switch over and do some cases in the APA Division as kind of a it's a morale-building kind of an exercise in that it gives them a break from what they are doing, learns a new area of law, that sort of thing. But it's not a regular practice. The administrative law judges have in the past, when qualified, sat as workers' compensation judges from time to time, but only during an emergency, for example, when we had a judge not too long ago take medical leave immediately and resign for medical reasons when the caseload was very heavy and we needed, in order to keep the cases on track, pull one of our administrative law judges over to do workers' compensation cases. It's the only time we've ever done that, and it's in both cases, going either way, not the regular course of events at OAH.
All right, Judge Krause, the other thing is, explain to me how a case management system and electronic filing system is going to cost $600,000. It kind of, you start dividing judges into that cost, and that's a chunk of money. And I'm just curious on how you come up with that kind of total.
Well, Mr. Chair, long ago, 3 years ago now, this topic of the case management system came up in the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And it was generally agreed by the council that we need to upgrade and get a electronic case management system for a number of reasons. The first reason is our system that we currently have is out of date and no longer is supported. So the Office of Enterprise Technology, that's a big no-no, and they want us to get something that is supported in the industry and is not outdated. Secondly, the case management system we discussed was part of this overall effort that both Commissioner Peterson and Senator Lilly discussed of trying to move the workers' compensation dispute resolution system forward at a faster pace than we currently do. And an electronic case management system would help us do that. How we got to the number is after there was general acknowledgement within the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council that we should seriously look at this, we went to the Office of Enterprise Technology and asked them for help, and they had us do a study, well, actually had an outside consultant do a study of what was out there in the industry for these kinds of things for other courts and report back to OET and to us. The study showed two things. One, that if we built this system from the ground up, it would be about $1.4 million, which that was the end of that conversation fairly quickly. They also came up with, in the study, 4 or 5 vendors that have case management systems more or less on the shelf that just need tweaking to fit our system that are used in other court systems around the country. The cost of those off-the-shelf systems range from about $100,000 up to $600,000. We could not go ahead and put out an RFP to get bids until we had money to encumber, and we're not allowed to encumber money in the special compensation fund until the legislature gives us that authority. So what we did was took the range of $100,000 to $600,000 and put that, the high number, in here and put the language in up to $600,000. Now, once the RFP is done and we have responses back, we'll know whether it's what bidder is successful. I'm confident that we're going to do it for a lot less than $600,000, but I can't say that for sure because we haven't done the RFP. All of the vendors that currently have these systems on the shelf, all of them but this one are under $300,000. There's just the one that's over that, and that's $600,000. So that's how we came up with the number. It's based on the study done by OET on what's out there as off-the-shelf, no bells and whistles kind of a system.
So will this system be able to be integrated with any other judicial software that might be used? Or I'm concerned that we build another silo here that has no connectivity with anybody else.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Good, very good question. It is our intent, and the preliminary language that we've written up in the RFP that we haven't issued yet requires that the system be OET compliant, first of all. Secondly, that it works with the Department of Labor, which has a system as well, so that we can coordinate between the Department of Labor and Industry and us. But it'll also, since the administrative law side of our shop also would have this case management system, it would work with all the other agencies that hire us to do their hearings. So it would be fully integrated with the executive branch. It possibly could, I suppose, be integrated with the judicial branch, but we don't have any interaction with the judicial branch, so that's really not been an issue that we've into it.
And the reason I bring that up is because you don't want a system that if down the road it should be that we're restricting ourselves so tightly that the expense would be out of line if that opportunity should come up.
Mr. Chair, that's why we're partnered with OET on this. They're the techie brains on this, and they assure us that any of the systems that they looked at in this study would be compatible with the other agencies that compatible with the other agencies that we do business with.
Senator Lilly, my understanding this goes to finance in
yes,
this next time.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for the testifiers or Senator Lilly? Senator Lilly?
I'd like to move that Senate File 1159 be passed and as amended and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Lilly moves that Senate File 1159 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you very much, Senator Lilly. I believe we are ready for Senator Hand. Thank you for your patience, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We're happy to be patient.
Senator
Hand, appreciate the opportunity to
we'll take Senate File 1101 off the table here and discuss the A2 amendment. Senator Gazelka moves the A2 amendment. And with that, Mr. Bodern, being that you work so quickly to get this done for us.
Mr. Chairman, what this does is basically reorganize what you see in, get my copy of the bill in front of me, what you see in subdivision 2 on the bottom of page 1 so that it's a little easier to understand who is doing what in terms of appointments. There are no substantive differences in the membership that is appointed by the non-legislative authorities or that serves ex officio. So the changes are shown beginning on the amendment on line 1.10, and that would have the speaker appointing two members, as we discussed previously, and then on line 1.13, the majority leader of the Senate would handle the appointment of three members, and the nonprofit organization selection has been reworded so that it's two representatives from nonprofit organizations, one of which serves all 87 counties, and then in addition a representative of a philanthropic organization. The remainder of what you see there is simply being reorganized so that it can be engrossed in the bill.
Any questions on the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
And I apologize for this. I just received the copy of this amendment. And what we need to do, I think what you can take care of, you need to mark up the amendment slightly. It deletes a little more than it needs to. You can begin by deleting line 23 of the amendment. Senator Hand or whoever is moving it on his behalf. And
I'll move.
Senator Gizelka moves to delete line 23.
And incorporate that. And then I think the remainder, I apologize. This is happening fairly quickly here. But now I think what you need to insert after deleting line 23 is page 2, delete lines 1 to 2. And that should take care of it.
So Senator Gizelka moves to delete on line 23. It would read, Mr. Bonner, would it read page 2, comma, delete lines 1 to 2?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, final go-around here. I apologize. I was looking at the original version of Senate File 1101, and this amendment works perfectly with the first engrossment. So there is no need for any oral amendment. And
Senator Gizelka withdraws his oral amendment.
Senator
Hand.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bonner, the first engrossment, is that the copy that includes the amendment that we made? I don't have a copy of that first engrossment, so I'm assuming this works. But
yes,
I did have
it is.
One just minor on page line 1.2 of the A2 amendment. Delete the. I think you need to say the second the.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand, point well taken. I think it works here. Just if we're really going to get down to the details here, the as it is referred to there begins with a lowercase t.
I'm sorry.
So it actually works.
I'm sorry. You're right. I was looking at that, and initially I thought, why would we delete that first the? And then, so, all right, we'll accept that.
Any further discussion on the A2? All in favor of Senator Gizelka's A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. All right. I think we've heard any questions on the amended Senate File 1101?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just inquire of Senator Hand as to what he thought about my question in terms of the people with disabilities.
Senator Hand.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, I think it's a good suggestion. I'm not, again, this was a bill that was brought to me by the folks from Lutheran Social Service. I don't know if there was a particular reason why, to your point, that it was limiting, but I certainly am open to expanding the category. But I guess I'd like to have some counsel from our...
Oh, we certainly would be too. Not a problem.
I believe, Senator Hand, this will have to go to rules and its next stop. Yes, it will. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me suggest an amendment. Let me move that on line 1-9 of the A2 amendment that the number 1 be stricken. And I don't know if there's anything magic, but it just strikes me as a little bit condescending to have all these folks involved working on behalf of people in the disability community, but not having people with disabilities involved with this as well. I was going to suggest substituting 3 for 1, but I don't know if 5 would be a better number. And after with, inserting diverse disabilities. Since my question
what
earlier,
line, Senator
this
Cohen?
Is on 1-9 of the A2 amendment. Since my earlier question indicated that It wasn't going to be arguably limited to people with developmental disabilities.
So what you're saying, Senator Cohen, is you would like the 1-9 to be three members with
diverse disabilities. So the amendment would be striking one, substituting three, individual, adding an S, and then after with, inserting diverse. And I would
with
just look for some advice from the author and the witness.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I'm okay with that. But one other just minor thing, that would be also on line 1.7, the 5 would have to be changed to 7.
Let's keep that in mind. I'm wondering, Senator Cohen, would adverse disabilities work better instead of diverse? Or, Mr. Bonner, how would you look at that?
A variety.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, I think what you want to emphasize here is each one would be a different type of disability.
Correct.
So I think one option would be to say three individual members with various disabilities. Diverse might work just as well. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not wedded to the whatever would be an appropriate word.
Mr. Bonner, to your, kind of your call.
Mr. Chairman, there. Reflecting on, I think that you want to be clear, each member would have a different type of disability. So I think in that instance, three individual members with different disabilities.
Three individual members with different disabilities. All right. Senator Cohen moves his oral amendment on 1.9 to state three individual members with different disabilities. Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, to that amendment, incorporating it also on line 1.7, striking the word 5, replacing with the word 7.
Yes.
7. Senator Cohen, does that work for you?
Yes.
All right. Obviously. On that oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Are we good to go on Senate File 1101? Senator Gazelka renews his motion that Senate File 1101, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Rules Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you for
Thank
your
you,
patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Let's move on to Senate File 1283. Senator Benson isn't here. Is Senator Daley here?
I think he's president of Congress.
Let's do Senator Daley, you're here today with House File 786.
Formerly known as Senate File 615.
Proceed.
There is an author's amendment. Not sure what the number is. Maybe the A11, possibly. I can tell you that if you just look to line 2.3, strike 50,000 and insert 100,000. And the reason for this, Mr. Chair and members, is that this updates the reporting threshold to match the IRS requirements.
Senator Daley moves the oral author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank my co-authors, Senator Cohen, Senator Wieger, and you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make 3 points. Number one, this requires the same method to be used in calculating the nonprofit salary and benefits, the figures that are sent to the Attorney General, as it's required by the recently revised IRS Form 990. And this is filed annually by the various charities. Number two, it does not change what data is reported, but it collects it in a way that is more transparent to the public and to potential donors and funders. And finally, this bill was introduced with the intent to increase consistency and conformity with regards to financial data reporting requirements for nonprofits and charities. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to Jeannie Fox and Gino Fragnito, who are going to provide some additional details.
Ms. Fox, please state your name and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I thank all our authors here today for working on this small but we think very important bill. Accomplishes basically three things: donor protection, clarity, and ease. And in your packets, I also bring two letters of support from the Minnesota Council on Foundations, as well as the Charities Review Council. And the accountants are here, so this is a bill. The accountants, the watchdogs, the charities all agree on that this actually enhances transparency. More specifically, it takes the definition of a salary right off the W-2 form. It's very clear. Wages and benefits are reported on a separate line.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Fox? Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota CPA Society. And as Ms. Fox said, this is a bill that we support, and conformity has been something that we've had a long-standing position in support of, and feel that this is a small piece of adding to and providing some ease and creating consistency in reporting methods for taxpayers and nonprofits across Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Daley?
I just mentioned that this passed in that other body, not to be mentioned, 129-0.
Okay.
If that's any indication of the support that's out there.
All right, Senator Daley, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 615 or House File 786 be recommended pass and move to the Senate floor.
Senator Daley moves that House
File 786 on the consent calendar.
Be recommended to pass as amended.
As amended, yes.
As amended and sent to the consent calendar. Any further discussion on that motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Do you know the House?
Senate File 1283, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm presenting today Senate File 1283. Before we begin, I would like to offer the A1 author's amendment.
It's the Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment.
I apologize, Senator Perry. I've been presenting a lot of bills in my committee.
On the A1 amendment, Senator Benson, would you like to explain it, or shall I have Mr. Bodern explain it?
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen the final version, but it adds two organizations to the Capital Security Advisory Committee.
Mr. Bodern, do you want to explain this?
Mr. Chairman, I received two separate requests, and I'm explaining why there's a second amendment being passed around relating to two different organizations that would be added to the membership of this committee. So shortly you'll see an A2 amendment coming around that lists the Minnesota Government Relations Council. Those two amendments can be moved together and adopted together, and they can be engrossed. So it would increase the total membership to 13, I believe.
need to take those one at a time, though, Ms. Barnes? Senator Gazelka then would move both the A1 and A2 amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Can I just inquire, and I'm not sure if this is of Senator Benson or I obviously understand what is being attempted, but I know that the membership is totally governmental, you know, state agencies, legislators, and obviously folks who are lobbyists spend a lot of time here. But if it includes, would there be other private entities to be included, or I don't know that we've ever placed in statute anybody from the Government Relations Council on a task force. I could be wrong on that, but
Senator Cohen, and committee members, I guess I would, I'll be straight with you on my feelings on this after I've thought about it since we've spoke. You know, number one, I'm not for designing commissions, but number two, if I had my druthers, I'd probably be looking at some kind of a delete all and just saying that the security for the Capitol falls under DPS and the State Patrol. I think what we're doing here, in all due respect, Senator Benson, I think what we're doing here is prolonging. I've gone through this, and for the life of me, when I look at this, I'm going with the lack of time that many folks have, you know, when you're sitting here and you're saying that the lieutenant governor, I believe, would probably end up being the chair, but then a couple of senators, I mean, I'm sorry, but I don't think they have a clue to the security. And I think what we're ultimately with this end up doing is wasting one quarter, two quarter, three quarter before anything is done, when I can sit here and talk with our sergeant at arms and I can talk with some of the troopers that are walking around this Capitol, and they know what needs to be done. I mean, that's their job. So I personally, I'm having a hard time with this one, Senator Cohen, and I just wanted to share that. I think there's a better way. I think what happened is everybody got caught up in the Representative Gifford issue, and I think security at this Capitol has been kicked down the road. That can has been kicked down the road, and I'm not so sure that we shouldn't just be looking at saying, we have good professional security people. Let them get it figured out be able to come back and say, here's what is going to be needed for us to do the job. And if that means we need to find a way to allocate more dollars for security, because I think we're looking at two things. I think we're looking at security for the people in the people's house here during session, and then we're looking at security when we're out of session. I think we have two different areas that we need to look at, and who better to do that than people that actually work in that field. So, Senator Benson, I'll let you say.
And Mr. Chair, thank you for those comments. They are very much in line with where I would like to be, but we need to consider security for the entire Capitol complex, not just the building, and the sergeants deal primarily with the legislative bodies. So we need to include judiciary. We need to include administration, because they take care of the cameras and the lighting and the grounds maintenance that can be part of a security plan. The request of the Ad Hoc Security Committee that met 9 times was that there be executive leadership and legislative support with sufficient input so that we can develop a security plan and request budget appropriation, because leadership has fumbled in the past, budgets are being cut, and our hope by putting legislators on this team, we have 3 branches of government that need to be considered, 1 that leads it, the executive branch, the legislative branch that appropriates the money for it, and if we don't give it appropriate weight, security will stumble again. And I agree, if it came to just this building, the sergeants do a great job, and they're aware of what goes on security-wise in the remainder of the complex. the State Patrol is also aware, but their primary responsibility is the governor's safety. And so the Department of Transportation, they provide backup if the people in charge of security at transportation call for support, but there is not a comprehensive view. And from my limited experience in security in the private sector, and from having listened to the State Patrol and other and the National Guard and other groups that have come forward, for example, in response to the RNC presentation, RNC that happened in the Twin Cities, so was it 2009? I've lost track of my dates already. Security keeps getting dropped. And so we hope this is a solution. We hope that at some point we get sufficient dollars to move security forward. But for right now, the governor stepped up and he is presenting executive leadership. And I'm happy to provide some legislative support for that work. If it is the opinion of this committee that we are overburdened, then let's take that into as input. Let's continue this discussion. But for now, the Historical Society is being added. They have the people down at the desk. If somebody walks in the door and is going to behave badly in this Capitol, they will be the first to see it. And the Council on Government Relations being added with the A2 amendment are the lobbyists that we see standing in the hallways quite regularly. It would be courteous to include them in some of our security administration and consideration, because they are here more than the school groups are. They are here even more than many of our legislators are. And so that is why I'm asking for that to be added as a consideration.
All right, we're going to work on the A1 and A2 amendment here that was given. Any further questions on adding those two? We'll get those moved. On the Gazelka A1 and A2 amendments, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendments prevail. All right, we're back on the Senate file 1283. Are there further discussion on this bill? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and a concern that I've been made aware of, and I can't see other than maybe in the data practices section through reference. There was some concern raised about the ability of this group to meet in not open session. Is that just on occasion when they're dealing with sensitive data, Senator Benson, or is that true universally?
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, on page 4, line 7, we'll see that this group would not be subject, the meetings of this committee would not be subject to Chapter 13D, which is our open meetings requirement. That was initially placed because the primary purpose of this committee is to hear reviews from security professionals talking about the gaps and the vulnerabilities in our security system, and so we defaulted to keeping the meetings closed. There have been a number of issues raised about how the information would come out of these meetings, and I will tell you at this point I am undecided if we should default to them being closed and open them provisionally, or default to them being open and close them quite regularly as would be needed for the security vulnerability. I am open to input from, there are several groups that have spoken to me about this, if they would present that information, and we have a rapid but vigorous debate here. Perhaps we can resolve this issue in this committee if the chair would indulge that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I have no strongly held opinion. I'm open to illumination myself.
Okay. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I do believe that it's very important that these meetings be open to the public unless there is a matter that is specifically relating to security issues. My understanding is that there already are some provisions in law that protect that information, and we should always take the opportunity to be, this is the people's house. This is our opportunity to talk openly and publicly about issues that are here. except when it affects those special situations. So I think that's how it should be in law. I do not feel that we should have the public excluded from what we talk about in this building, except when we say it's okay for them to hear what we have to say. I think we should always have our opportunity to have public discussion of what is available, what we are talking about, and only close it when it specifically is an area that we are concerned with.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I'm persuaded by Senator Lilly. I have an opinion now. Do you have an amendment? Do you have an amendment?
Senator Cohen, did you have your hand up? Did I miss you?
I had a different issue.
Oh, so. Okay. Mr. Bodern, what are your thoughts on this?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is written right now, the committee would determine how to proceed. In other words, whether to default to open meetings or to begin with the presumption the meeting would be open to the public or whether to presume it would be closed. If you want to specify that in this bill, you could add a sentence after line 4.7 that would read, meetings of the committee shall be open to the public unless a majority of the membership of the committee votes to conduct a closed meeting.
Senator Lilly?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bodern, would that be preferable to just eliminating the word not on line 4.7?
Mr. Bodern?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly, then you get into some considerations about the operation of the open meeting law as it relates to legislative members. The legislature has traditionally provided its own open meeting policies, and it's a little confusing where you have some legislative membership and some public and executive membership, exactly how the open meeting law would apply. There are also a variety of other procedural requirements that apply under the open meeting law that are not simply related to keeping the meetings open to the public, like providing copies of all documents that the members use to make decisions and so forth. So it's a little more complicated than simply whether or not members of the public may observe the proceedings.
I'm inclined to think, Senator Lilly, that I like what I heard from just thinking about the discussions, even when I was actively wearing a uniform that we would have. I'm concerned that some of those discussions shouldn't be done in a public atmosphere just because of the delicate nature. I believe I have one or two people that would like to weigh in on this. If you want to come up and please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. We are concerned about the very provision that Senator Lilly has identified. The concept of the bill is perfectly legitimate in terms of Senator Benson's assumption that most meetings would be closed to the public. There's no doubt that would occur. However, if you took out the word not on line 7, page 4, as was proposed, creating a presumption that this body would be subject to the open meeting law, what would happen then is that there's already a provision in the statute, the open meeting statute, that gives any public body subject to the open meeting law a very broad prerogative to close meetings for security, discussions, deliberations, briefings, presentations, things like that. And counsel is correct that the open meeting law does impose a certain limited range of procedural requirements than any public body. But I don't think they'd be burdensome here, and I think that they would be helpful to ensuring what Senator Lilly has pointed out. I mean, after all, the Capitol complex is arguably the epicenter of public participation in the state of Minnesota. And if nothing else, symbolically, I think we should start from the proposition that it's got to be a pretty serious issue to limit the public's right of access and participation for security matters or for anything else. To go back to the chair's concern, I participated in drafting the security exception of the open meeting law 6 or 7 or 8 years ago. It's very broad. It's regularly used throughout the state by local public bodies. And I think it would more than suffice to address the legitimate concerns that Senator Benson has identified. When a topic comes up it can be closed. But what if the committee is discussing some broader topic, such as the interaction between the First Amendment and the importance of particular security measures, which could come up in this location? Some of that maybe should be public, or the organizational decisions the committee will make. Shouldn't that be public? So that's our view on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. When I saw this bill, I was just, for me personally, sort of saying, totally exempt from the open meeting law. Down a little bit more into it, and I would oppose being exempt from the open meeting law. As Mr. Anfinson did describe, two of your, one a former colleague of yours and now a current colleague, did this legislation where the security exception. It was after 2001 and recently what happened with Obama almost 10 years, September 11, 2001. Across the country, there were a number of initiatives to have discussion of security-related items in closed settings for the public bodies. And if you look at 13D, 05, subdivision 3D, there's a whole paragraph there. It's very broad. Meetings may be closed to receive security briefings and reports. And it goes into a few other things, and it says information discussed which would pose a danger to public safety or compromise security procedures or responses. That's pretty broad. So if you take away the not and just say you're under the open meeting law, and a number of Homeland Security groups do that here within the state and other public bodies and across the country, what they'll do on the agenda, you'll see they'll talk about in general things, and then they have a portion of it closed, and then they come back and reopen again. So this is not like some new thing. And I wanted to comment a little bit more on what Mr. Anfinson indicated. I'll just give you four examples. One, if you take a look at what the charge of the committee is, they can discuss possibility of what should be the way that people should get a permit to come and protest or to petition their government in front of the state capitol. And to where there might be some discussion about that in a secret meeting, I have some concerns about. Number two, I'm very much aware of the technology that is being used for security. And I interact a lot with government entities all the time, asking them what type of cameras they're placing in, the sophisticated audio pickup where they can pick up people talking in buildings and things like that. Let's say if there was a discussion about having some type of electronic surveillance system, which a lot of capitals across the country have, and want to place that here in the Minnesota complex, that should be a public discussion. The issue of whether or not people who are now legally able to have guns and do come up here to the Capitol, and just by doing a letter to the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, if there is a feeling about having changed that policy, and part of your recommendations when you send a report on January 15th, that should be open to the public. I mean, I can go on and on and on. Well, and the last important thing, I've seen here a lot of times that people come here to interact with the legislators and all that. And I think if there's going to be a discussion about how access questions, particularly like over the last several years, as many of you know, you've got these little passes where you can get you can go in a door, but me as a constituent or a person, I can't. So I have to go around the other door. So when you discuss about having certain areas that have accessibility for the lobbyists and the employees here, but the constituent like myself or others who don't have any of those, that should be, those kinds of discussions should be to the public. So Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think this is, from my perspective, a no-brainer. It should be under the Minnesota government open meeting law. Secondly, there's a lot of flexibility for you to close the meetings if you so desire.
Thank you. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we amend line 4.7 to remove the word not.
Senator Lilly makes an oral amendment to, on line 4.7, remove the word not. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, respectfully, I would like counsel to advise me on the implications for this meeting. Looking at the 13D section and trying to understand it in the short period of time, the administrative responsibilities for meetings that are primarily going to be closed. I'd like to be advised on that before accepting the amendment.
Mr. Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, providing a brief synopsis of Chapter 13D as it would apply to this committee, there would be a number of procedural requirements. As I mentioned briefly, there's a requirement to keep a journal of all public, of all votes, and there's a requirement to provide, make public any copies of materials distributed to the members of the governing body. I think regardless of whether they're distributed to the public, if they're public, provided at the meeting to all members, there are protections that remain for non-public data. There are a variety of other allowances for allowing some members to participate from a remote location. I think one other significant difference is Chapter 13D spells out the specific circumstances when meetings may be closed, in particular when dealing with data not classified as public, under, and it's very specific in that regard, and a variety of other circumstances. The big difference is basically that if it's, if the determination whether to close the meeting is left to the committee, I think the best analogy would be it's somewhat more like a legislative proceeding. Legislative proceedings are not subject to the open meeting law, and it would be within the discretion of the committee to determine whether to close the meeting. Chapter 13D would provide more restraints on that.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would prefer not to amend as Senator Lilly had suggested, and rather I believe council advised earlier that the meetings would be open unless voted on by the members of the committee. I think at least beginning, the nature of what we will be discussing will be primarily security vulnerabilities, and it seems administratively more challenging to simply delete the not as opposed to the amendment opposed requested earlier.
Senator Lilly, if maybe I can ask on, you know, on the on Mr. Bonner's suggestive language, to me seems that it would be a little bit of a compromise here as we move forward, and as I listen and think about that, it's, and I trust me, I remember when the open meeting law first came about, and I was in the media 100%, and I fought long and hard for it, but having walked in the moccasins of somebody that's worn a badge and worked on security and stuff, I'm thinking that when we have a legislative body like we're creating here, for some reason I'm thinking Mr. Bodern's suggestion feels a little bit more comfortable for me. Maybe you might give me your thoughts on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I don't know that there can be a comfortable level with this. It seems to me that the threshold that we are talking about is not that significant. It seems to me that the issues that could be discussed in this forum as were presented are significant issues to the public, and I think that the public should have a right to hear those issues. I think maintaining a journal of the votes, public copies, remote locations, the circumstances when they are closed, I think this threshold level is not that significant that we could not follow the same laws that have been established, well-battled, well-thought-out, discussed by many for other meeting criteria. It seems to me that this should have the same criteria applied to it in this situation as we have applied legislatively in other situations. So I really feel strongly that this is the correct way to go. Obviously, I will go with the votes of the committee, but I do feel passionately that this is the correct method here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
Just a question for us to consider as we're discussing vulnerabilities. Do we want everyone to know, do we want the bad guys to know the specific vulnerabilities, where the weaknesses are, so that they can attack those, whatever they might be? It's just a question that I think is worthy of some discussion.
I defer, Mr. Chairman, your members first. Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's the question in front of us. I think it's clear that under 13D, the meetings can be closed at any time for any reason by the members of the committee. So if they're going to be discussing those sorts of things, those meetings will be closed. I think the question in front of us is whether or not some of the administrative provisions that 13D outlines are appropriate. And I think, you know, I support Senator Lilly's articulation of the issues, and I think 13D does provide for some considerations beyond just simply opening and closing, providing for record and communication, record of proceedings, and a means of communicating those.
All right. Mr. Is it Anfinson?
It's Anfinson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, to Senator Daley's very appropriate question, if you look at the section of the open meeting law that allows all security discussions to be closed at the discretion of the public body, and it just simply takes a majority vote. And if you also look at the corresponding portions of the State Open Records Law or Data Practices Act, which again will allow this group to prevent public access to virtually any recorded material that the bad guys could possibly make use of, and again at the committee's discretion, you have a completely closed circle to protect that important public interest. What you lose if you go the direction of simply allowing the committee by majority vote with no standard to close any meeting they want to is random grounds for closing meetings that may have nothing to do with security. And there will be issues that this committee deals with: the election of its chair, adoption of its procedures, financial issues, things like that the public should hear about. But again, Mr. Chairman, I think the more important issue is by allowing sort of a random basis for closing any meeting simply by a majority vote, you put something of a spike in public confidence. Why? Why was this done? By using the open meeting law provision that is now almost, we have 10 years of experience and familiarity with, you have a empirical standard that the committee then can point to and say, this has been endorsed for a decade by the legislature already. It's a legitimate basis for closing the meeting. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
And if I could point out one more factor. I love our lobbyists. I love the lobbying contingency that we have here at the Capitol of the MGRC. It's all good. But there is some perception that lobbyists have special privilege, special access. I think Mr. Neumeister touched a little bit on that. It's not just a perception. It sometimes is carried out in a somewhat informal fashion, people getting special parking spots after hours, and, you know, stuff occurs just through presence and familiarity. I think it'd be particularly important, the presence of the MGRC on this committee, to do what we can to really increase the level of confidence that the public has, so that it doesn't look like there's a closer relationship institutionally by those who are running and operating and overseeing some major elements of the Capitol than is warranted.
Any further discussion?
Judiciary.
great drama here today.
Good for you.
No, I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it was the last thing you wanted to do.
Senator Benson,
yes.
Could I make a suggestion? Because I want to be clear on this, too. I would like to suggest that we lay this on the table, because there's parts of this that I want to get clarity between both sides here when I talk with Mr. Bodern and that. To be honest with you, I haven't myself personally looked at the open meeting law for a while. And just for my own... I think if we could lay it on the table, we can bring it. We can come back Wednesday with it, and have a clear thought process here, and maybe take care of it that way, if that would be acceptable.
Mr. Chair, this does have another stop at judiciary. If that gives you any comfort,
I understand. But I guess. I mean, we're pushing on some timelines here, but I guess. I would just like to have that extra time just to really look at this closely. I would like to do that. I would hate to see us do something here that wasn't completely thought out on all of our parts, and I just think the extra time would be beneficial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could make a request of Senator Lilly, if we could work on this together so that we can bring something forward that meets our needs and perhaps include the chair in some of that work.
Well, even a better clarity on my part, Senator Lilly, I'm just a little bit uncomfortable at this point, and I'd like to have that extra time.
Mm-hmm.
And we can bring it in. Senator Wager.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable voting for Senator Lilly's amendment. It's going to go to judiciary, and we do have a lot on our next agenda, but if you want to lay it over, fine. Senator Lilly, were you going to withdraw that amendment in the meantime then, or?
Mr. Senator Chair, is that Lilly necessary to lay this over?
I guess I would prefer that.
I'm okay with the non.
Then I will withdraw that motion.
All right. Senator Benson, Senator Lilly withdrew his motion, and we will lay this on the table. All right. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to mention, Senator Benson, if we could continue the discussion, maybe even out of here, that I started in transportation about this committee's interaction with the committee that's been established, the commission that's established for the historic rehab of the building.
I would be happy to do that, Senator Dibble. We have a number of issues.
I still don't understand how the two interface meaningfully.
We need to discuss several issues. We will do that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Members, we are going to meet twice on Wednesday, the regular time at 1 o'clock, and then we'll come back at 6 o'clock Wednesday night. I can tell you that Wednesday night we will be taking up the Racino bill, just so everyone knows that. There is a possibility that we might have a quick meeting on Thursday just to move some bills that were re-referred. Senator Wigger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. On Racino, have you said any ground rules in terms of proponents, opponents on each side of the issue?
Well, I'm thinking that if we had a half hour to 45 minutes from each side, I think we've all heard quite a bit of it over the last couple of years, but I would like to have them be able to present, and then it's up to the committee after that.
So, thank you.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, on the
Senator